Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher.
In September of 2022, a Kurdish-Iranian woman named Mahsa Amini died after being brutalized by the Islamic Republic's morality police. Her crime? Authorities deemed that she was not wearing her hijab, the Islamic religious head covering required of all Iranian women, properly. Amini was taken into custody, where she ended up being beaten savagely by her captors. She ultimately died of her injuries. The incident touched off a groundswell of outrage within Iran. Protests broke out in Iran's capital of Tehran and other major cities, as Iranians took to the street to vent their anger at an unaccountable and out-of-touch regime. A year on, these protests, known as the Woman Life Freedom Protests, have persisted. They've also changed shape. From their start as an outpouring of outrage at regime brutality, they become something more, a fundamental rejection of the Islamic Republic itself. Someone who's been keeping her finger on the pulse of the Iranian street is Golnaz Esfandiari. Golnaz is the managing editor of Radio Farda, the Persian service of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. She's also an Iran analyst for democracy watchdog Freedom House and authors the Iran chapter of its annual Freedom in the World survey. She has been published and cited by The New Yorker, Foreign Policy, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and other leading publications. Golnaz, wonderful to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start with the protests, because they're remarkable in many ways. They've proven to be both more widespread and more persistent than previous rounds of unrest that we've seen in the country, like those that took place in 2007 and 2009, 2017, 2019. So I'm curious, why is that? What's so different this time around?
Just to make it clear, currently there are no more protests. But as you said, the protests we saw, the anti-establishment protests that broke over the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Shina Amini in the custody of the morality police, they lasted for several weeks, even months. And we had never seen protests against the government lasting for such a long time. I think one reason is that these protests were not over a political decision, unlike what we saw in 2009, when people took to the streets over what they saw as a stolen election. And they were not about the economy. Those protests in 2019 were about the very poor economy over a sudden rise in the price of gasoline. But these protests, they were just because Mahsa Jina Amini could have been anyone. She could have been anyone's daughter, anyone's sister, anyone's cousin. So people were outraged that, first of all, she was a guest in Tehran. She was visiting. She was arrested by the morality police, apparently because they claimed that her hijab was not okay. But then when the government released videos of her, she looked fine. She had a long, you know, coat, and she had a headscarf. So there was nothing wrong with her hijab. So that caused a lot of outrage in the Iranian society. And people took to the streets, people came outside the hospital where she died. And then at her funeral, people started protesting. So it started as a protest over women's issues, over the hijab. But then, you know, people called for an end of to the Islamic Republic. And they started destroying symbols of the Islamic Republic, including women were burning their headscarf. They were, you know, cutting their hair in public. It was unprecedented. And then later on, during the protest, they targeted the images of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, and even the images of the founder of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini. Apparently, there were reports that a museum devoted to Khomeini was burned down. And clerics were targeted in the street. Young people would go after them and, you know, hit their turbans. And many people just wanted an end to the Islamic Republic. And these were people, women, of course, were a major part of the protesters, but very young people. That's why so many young people were also killed. They were among the victims of the brutal state crackdown that followed.
Well, and you raise an important point because you're right that the protests aren't going on the way that they manifested at the outset. But those acts of resistance to the Islamic Republic have continued, and you sort of see these sporadic flares all the time. And it strikes me that this is remarkably resilient as a dynamic, and there's some sort of Rubicon. We've crossed some sort of Rubicon in the Islamic Republic. So how has the Iranian regime responded to all this? You know, what did the regime do, right? Because the enemy also gets a vote.
First of all, you made a very important point that there are still people that are still resisting. For example, the women are resisting the forced hijab. You're still seeing women taking to the streets without a headscarf, despite warnings by officials, despite facing the risk of being arrested, being denied of public services. Students, you know, have been banned from studies for not wearing the hijab. A number of prominent actresses have been banned from working in the Islamic Republic because they appeared, they published images of themselves without the headscarf. So the government has been responding with force, with brute force. They killed about 500 protesters, including 70 children, really young people, teenagers who took to the streets and were killed, you know, just because they wanted change. And they arrested over 20,000 people. They released many of them. They announced an amnesty, but many of those who were released, there were cases against them. They were summoned later and threatened. They pressured even lawyers who defended the protesters. And they also launched a crackdown on the media and on journalists. As we speak, two young journalists, two women who helped break the story of Mahsa, Jina Amini, are still in prison just because they did their job. They didn't do anything else. And officials have been claiming that they worked for the US, that they were spies, but it's all nonsense, of course. It's part of their efforts to spread disinformation. So, as I said, they responded with force, with crackdown, with repression, with torture, and with more filtering and pressure on the media, censorship, basically.
No, and on that last point, I think it's very important. And, you know, this is a podcast about information warfare and propaganda. So let me drill down on that a little bit, because in previous rounds of protests, like the 2009 Green Movement protests, a big part of the regime response was informational, right? Very simply, the Iranian regime figured out that the protesters were going online to organize. So it went online as well, and it throttled the protests there, and it stayed there. Over the years, this informational clampdown to sporadic protests within Iran has gotten more sophisticated. And now it involves everything from internet blackouts to surveillance of the population, to slow down of bandwidth, to all sorts of other methods of societal control. What are we seeing in the context of the current round of protests?
So the government increased its internet censorship. And despite now the protests are almost over, they're here and there, people taking to the streets are chanting from the rooftops. But despite that, we're receiving reports that they're disrupting VPNs. So these are tools that Iranians use to access uncensored information, to access our website, for example, to get information, to watch movies, to connect with each other. And we're receiving increasing reports. They're saying basically the VPNs are not working. So they have toughened their internet censorship. They also, whenever there's something they could take to the street, there's for them sensitive times, they disrupt the internet and they slow the internet. And there are internet disruptions every week in Zahedan, in Sistan and Balochistan province, because people are every week still taking to the streets and chanting slogans against the establishment. And they're disrupting the internet every week there. In 2019, we saw an internet shutdown. For a week, nobody could get online. During these protests, they didn't do it this way. What they did is that during the night hours, when people took to the streets, they would disrupt the internet. But during the day, people could, you know, access the internet so they could do their business, because, you know, in disrupting the internet is also a huge blow to businesses, and it makes people even angrier. So they were trying not to do that to a great extent, you know, but this regime, censorship is one of the tools it uses, with or without protest.
So I'm curious about something. From your vantage point at Radio Farda, you get to hear from ordinary Iranians.
Yes.
And a lot of things that they tell you are not common knowledge, or at least not common knowledge here in the West. What are you hearing from them directly about current conditions, and what's their view of the government, and how have things changed?
You know, people are extremely frustrated because of the very poor economy that has been crushed by US sanctions, of course, but years of mismanagement. People are becoming poorer. They're struggling to make ends meet. The number of poor is rising. And they're still very much angry about the killing of children. As I said, more than 70 children were killed by the government, by regime forces. And these are not the things that people can forget. So there's a lot of anger against this establishment. And there's the gap has been widening. I would say that the majority of people don't support this establishment. The number of their supporters is shrinking. And it's very obvious by the protests we saw and by the actions the regime is taking. This is a regime that is increasingly afraid of its own people.
No, and I think that's an enormously profound point, because what you have is an Iranian regime that is in retreat or defensive at home, but it's being aggressive abroad. And I wanted to ask you a question about the current war between Israel and Hamas, because obviously there's a very large Iranian dimension to all this that isn't being covered.
On support for Hamas over the years.
Sure, but also in the context of the Iranian people themselves, right? Because what we've seen is a massive and enormously troubling outpouring of anti-Israel and anti-Semitic sentiment in Western capitals as a result of the war, as the war has gone on. But that's not really the reaction that ordinary Iranians are having.
Not at all.
So talk about that a little bit.
You know, I want to tell you two interesting things that I've seen in the past days. A very prominent filmmaker was murdered in Tehran. And during his funeral, one of the people, the speakers, started talking about, you know, fighting Israel. And people started chanting, booing her, and started chanting, "No to Gaza, no to Lebanon. May my life be sacrificed for Iran," which is very much very telling. It's a chant that people have been chanting during anti-establishment protests, but it shows that they're just basically saying no to Iran's regional policies. In another instance, there was a football match and they declared a moment of silence for the people in Gaza. And people started, you know, horning and shouting and telling them that they didn't want to, you know, hold this moment of silence. And this is not because they're indifferent about the killing of civilians. Of course, you know, you can't be indifferent, but they're saying no to Iran's policies, to Iran telling them that Israel is your enemy. Most people don't believe that. They have nothing against Israel. They have nothing against the US. So it's very interesting. You see in most countries in the region, people taking this in the streets, protesting against Israel, you know, are in favor of Palestinians. But in Iran, it's you only see these kind of protests that are sponsored by the state. You know, you don't see people doing that on their own. So there's a big difference I see there. And in general, I think Iranians are one of the most pro-US nations in that region. During 9/11, people took to the streets, you know, there was a candle vigil and people were mourning the innocent victims of the terrorist attacks.
I think that's really something that's being missed here in the West. The old saying is that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And you very clearly see that dynamic as more and more Iranians move into the opposition against the current regime. Their worldview is shifting in a pretty profound way.
Yeah, so of course, and in the Western media, Khamenei, when he says something outrageous, that's the headline, right? And people don't go to say, but this is not what the Iranian people are thinking, you know? They don't realize how vast is the gap between the Iranian and the establishment.
No, right, exactly. And so this was going to be my last question, because I wanted to look into the future a little bit. Iran is a society in profound flux on virtually every level that we're talking about, on economics, on demographics. What do you see as the big stories that are coming down the pike? What should we be attuned to? We don't pay enough attention to Iranian society generally, but it's also a society that's going to undergo some pretty dramatic transformations in the years ahead.
This is it's a very young society, and there are millions of people living in that country. And the only thing they want is to have a normal life. They can't have it because of a very repressive establishment. There's, as I said, there's lots of anger. And one thing that we should be watching is that there's going to be more protests at some point. I don't know when. I don't know if it's going to be next week, next month, or next year, but they're going to happen. And we don't know what's going to trigger them. But maybe the economy. We're seeing people, you know, nurses, others taking to the streets because of the poor economy, pensioners. We're seeing these kind of protests every day. And at some point, there's going to be an explosion, I'm afraid. You know, it could be violent because there's so much anger against the establishment. Another thing that we should be watching is, Khamenei is 84 years old, the supreme leader. He's going to die at some point. And they've already taken steps for the succession. So they've made sure that now most centers of power are being controlled by hardliners. And we don't know who's going to succeed him, if they've made up their choice, or there's going to be battle over the succession. So that's something else to watch. And after Khamenei dies, you know, some people say that revolutionary guards are going to take control of the country. Even now, they have a lot of control over everything. Or there could be an opportunity for change if someone comes to power who's not as hardline as Khamenei and his supporters. This is definitely something we should be watching in the coming months and years.
Thank you so much. And thank you for everything that you do in keeping an eye on an enormously important issue.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And, as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.